This podcast is general in nature and hasn't taken your circumstances into account. It's important you consider your personal circumstances and speak to a financial advisor before deciding what's right for you. Any general tax information provided is provided as a guide only. Now, here's Shane and Deanna.
G'day everyone, thanks for joining us.
This week you had a note about seven things that investors need to know about the Australian property market. First off, why did you pick seven, not five or three or ten?
Well, I have this theory that all lists should have an odd number on there rather than an even number. In fact, maybe it dates back to when I saw this film called History of the World. It was about 40 years ago now, Mel Brooks' film. You've got Moses coming down from Mount Sinai. He has two tablets and just as he's about to say, here are the, he drops one tablet and says the Ten Commandments. Well, the 11th commandment was that whenever thou has a list, it should always have an odd number on it rather than even. It's a bit like, you know, when you start off with a list, you're not going to say, here's two reasons why you should do X, Y, Z. You'd say three.
Okay, so what are the seven things that we need to know?
I'll have to read these things off because I'm not going to remember them all. But the first one is the Aussie property market is excessively expensive. Even when you do international comparisons, when you look at price-to-rent ratios, whether you look at price-to-income ratios, Aussie property looks massively expensive. If you look at the ratio of home prices to average wages or household income, it's doubled over the last 20-odd years. So very expensive property. But you should also know it's very diverse. You've got cities which I reckon, like Perth, is still relatively cheap. If you're over there in Perth living there, you'd say, well, that's not the case. It's expensive. Mm-hmm. But measured against other cities, it's actually quite cheap. There's also good value out there still in regional property around Australia. So you can't say it's all the same. And we see this in different cycles across the cities. Perth right now is going gangbusters, whereas Melbourne is virtually dead in the water in terms of price gains. I guess another key point is that if you look at mortgage stress, you know, everyone would think, even if you'd asked me 2 years ago with interest rates going up like they have, I would have thought there would have been a lot more mortgage stress. And of course, we often hear about this, but when you look at the numbers, number of mortgages that are in arrears or delinquent, not making their payments, it's actually very, very low.
Why has it happened? How have people been able to offset the interest rate increases?
Look, I think it's a combination of things. People came out of the pandemic with good buffers built up. You couldn't spend, so you saved the income you got. That helped them. Of course, we had a strong labour market. So if you were struggling with your mortgage, you could always work extra hours. People have been able to cut back discretionary spending. Of course, there's a limit to those things. And yep. I think at the end of the day, and this is the fourth point, interest rates still matter. It determines how much you can pay for a property. And obviously that big fall in interest rates from the highs of the 1980s, when mortgage rates typically around 17%, baby boomers like me love to say that one, now then they fell as low as 2%. That underpinned huge gains in Australian property prices, made possible those huge gains. People could pay more for property. But of course it can get swamped by other things. And right now, of course, you could argue, this is the fifth point, that it's chronically undersupplied. And I think that's dominated over the course of the last year. We've had a huge influx of people into Australia, record immigration levels, I think something like 550,000 over the year, the 12 months to September last year. And those numbers look like they've stayed very high on charts that you put together. And of course, that means when you add that together with natural growth, we should be building something like 250,000 dwellings a year at present. Reality is completion's down around 170,000. So we're not building enough to house the number of people in Australia. That's gone on for many years now. So we've got this chronic undersupply, and that's I guess, maintaining upwards pressure on prices, despite what mortgage rates have done. Sixth point is that no matter what you try and do, forecasting the Australian property market is very difficult. Michelle Bullock pointed this out a month or so ago. After the last interest rate meeting in Australia, she said that every time we try, we seem to get it wrong. And I must admit, my own luck in trying to forecast the swings in the property market hasn't been too flash over the last year or so, last couple of years. And you may also think over the last 20 years, you've heard plenty of calls that Aussie property market's about to crash. But for some reason, it just keeps on keeping on, often because once prices start coming down, RBA's cutting interest rates, there's a supply shortfall. It's like all hands on deck to try and push the property market back up again. Mm. I guess the final point is, and this is relevant for investors, if you go back over the last almost 100 years for which we've got data, returns, as best that I can estimate them, from shares and property are roughly similar. Now, of course, people gear more into property rather than they do in shares, so the gearing will enhance that return. But average returns, if you exclude the impact of gearing and things like franking credits from shares and property, are about the same at about 11% per annum. So those things, I think, are all worth bearing in mind. But the key one here is it is very expensive, but we do have a very diverse property market out there. So you can't say the same comments about Sydney that you can make in relation to Perth or Hobart. But I think one of the big, big problems we have in Australia is this massive undersupply.
Mm.
I think one thing that I was going to ask you about, what were your thoughts on this? Because over Easter, you go on these driving trips in Australia. I love to get in the Holden, drive off somewhere. This time around, my wife and I went down to Eden, which is on Australia's Sydney's New South Wales south coast, almost down as far as Victoria. Fantastic place to go. Beautiful countryside, beautiful scenery. But in my car, in the Holden, I'm lucky enough to still have a CD player. A lot of cars don't have that anymore. So I've got the option of listening to Spotify, CDs, or the radio. And I jumped between all of them. For some reason, I drove off with only Andy Williams CDs. Andy Williams was a sort of a general TV entertainment sort of show that was on in the late 60s, early 70s. But I loved his voice. Ronald Reagan, former president of the US, said once he was a national treasure because of his velvet voice. Anyway, he would do all these happy songs, often songs that had already been recorded by somebody else, like the Carpenters, songs with lyrics like, "Why do birds suddenly appear when you're near?" The other group of songs I had was from Taylor, and I love Taylor. In fact, I think we both do. And I'm surprised. I'm listening to Andy, all this happy upbeat stuff, yeah, bright tunes, and then I put on Taylor and she's singing songs like All Too Well about Red Scarf and someone who's ripped her off and so on. And I sort of wonder what's happening. And then I was reading the newspaper about someone in Europe, a group, has actually done a study on music that compares the songs of 50 years ago, Andy Williams and the Carpenters, with today, and found that music has become angrier, gloomier and simpler than it was 50 years ago. And it made me wonder whether that tells us something about society. Have we gotten richer but far less happy?
Well, there was another study that we looked at this week from The Economist that showed that liberals, or the true liberals, so the people voting to the left, are more depressed than the conservatives. And then that got me to thinking as well about consumer sentiment levels. And we actually got a reading on that this week in Australia for April, and it showed another fall, and consumer confidence in Australia has now been negative for 26 months. So over 2 years, that's the longest period that it's been this negative outside of the early 90s recession. So consumers are clearly feeling like we are in a recessionary type of environment. But against that, you've had the unemployment rate at a 48-year low, consumer incomes boosted by high wages growth and strong labour market conditions, but I guess at the same time, obviously those cost of living pressures. So I think there's a few things going on. Obviously, the last 3 years, the aftermath of the pandemic has seen this big lift in inflation, higher interest rates, and also in Australia, we've had this increasing tax burden on our income. So that drag on incomes, or I guess on real wages, has really been felt. So even though we have seen some lift in wages growth, inflation has mostly surpassed that. So people are feeling like they're not getting compensated for those higher rates of inflation. That makes people not feel that great about the outlook. And I also think that generally the move to a more woke world has left people feeling more depressed about issues because there's more things to worry about. You know, the climate, the role of the government. I think the last 10 to 15 years of economic downturns and recessions also makes people worried about the outlook for employment. Like if you look at the consumer sentiment index that we had this week, unemployment expectations that consumers have improved, but they're still much higher than where the actual unemployment rate is. So people are still feeling worried about their job prospects. And I think also in the last few years in particular, people are getting worried that they're going to be replaced by a machine. So it does feel like maybe there's more issues that consumers are worried about, which plays out both in economic data, like in consumer sentiment readings, but also through things like your song choices and things that you hear on the radio. And also I think people can relate to more of those depressed songs that Taylor puts out, because sometimes it is easier to feel a bit, you know, down about things rather than feeling happy and optimistic.
She did put out a happy album, as our colleague Me Boo said, the Lover album, one of my favourites from Taylor, but it didn't get as good of reviews. And yeah. You sort of wonder whether People said, oh, we don't like that happy stuff in the Lover album, like Me, the song Me, as opposed to the more personal, reflective, somewhat more negative stuff, lyrics in some of the other songs. But my theory on it is the difference between those to the left and those to the right. Those on the right probably think, oh, well, free market forces will fix it up anyway, so we don't have to get ourselves into a tether about some problem. It will be resolved by market forces. Whereas those on the left think, well, there's a massive problem there. The system is rigged against us. We've got to get the government to do something. And if the government's not doing something, that just adds to the angst. I guess another factor is I think back to my parents in 1970 when those happier songs were coming out. They weren't all happy. I know there was protest songs against the Vietnam War and one guy was telling us about the eve of destruction associated with the Cold War at the time. But expectations were a lot lower. Yeah, my parents were happy to get a two-bedroom house with a dining room which merged with the lounge room, whereas these days expectations have gone a lot higher. If you don't get that, then you feel hard done by. So that's probably made it also harder for natural material gains to then meet up with expectations, which, of course, have run a lot faster ahead.
So higher income, higher wealth doesn't necessarily mean more happiness.
I don't think it does. I think it does if you go from a very low level. If you're an emerging country and you're living near subsistence, you know, pre-emerging country, you're living near subsistence, you get your income level up a little bit, you don't have to worry as much about your health and your clothing and your food, you will feel a lot happier. But then when you compare rich countries over the last 50 years, happiness levels haven't improved that much.
And inequality's gone up, so that's another factor that makes people unhappy.
People actually measure themselves relative to each other. So you've got rich people feeling happier than poor people. But if the gap has widened, it may actually work against things. So that's a factor. But I like to call it the hedonic treadmill, that we all think if we get one more gadget, one more thing, I get a bigger boat or a better car or something or other, I'll feel happier. And
so the moral of the story is we need to focus on the basics.
That's right. Focus on the basics.
Well, the oil price has been moving up in the past week, about $90 a barrel now. People are saying could be some geopolitical concerns because of the potential involvement of Iran in the Middle East war and also high oil demand. And a lot of people now are talking about high petrol prices in Australia.
In fact, when you can go to the Motorbath website and look on, say, Sydney or many other cities around Australia, you see this constant pattern, the ritzier, better off areas where people don't care much about what the petrol price is, or they do, but not as much. They tend to be red, well above the average. Whereas if you say take Sydney, you sort of there's this band that sort of goes out to the inner southwest, inner west, then southwest, where it's green, well below average. There's also what you call a discounting cycle across various Australian cities. It's, I think, weekly in Perth. That's the most extreme. Always goes up on the same day of the week, just about. In Sydney, it's about every 3 weeks. And that seemed to bottom out around Easter, which is when I last filled up nicely, around $1.80, and then now it's gone back up again. But globally, yeah, there are problems there. There's tensions in the Middle East, of course, as we know, with Israel, but there's a fear that maybe Iran will be drawn in directly, given various issues between Israel and Iran, and that country supplies something like 3 million barrels per day, 10% of world oil supply. Then you've got issues, I think, around Venezuela. I don't know what the details are there. Issues with Russian refineries, which are getting attacked by Ukraine for obvious reasons as part of their war. And, of course, global demand has been stronger as the global economy this year has held up far better than expected. So all of these things are playing into it. The surprising thing I find is that even with those things and where the world oil price is today and then adjust it back into Australian dollars, there's no way I can explain Australian petrol prices where they are.
So and you mean that they're too high?
Like, I reckon they're too high, whether it's $1.80 or $2.30 and take an average of, say, $1.90, $2 a litre, we should be at least 30 cents below that.
So who's making the money?
The only way I can explain it is maybe oil refineries are charging, are getting bigger margins there. Because if you think about it, at the time of the Ukraine war, the world oil price went to around $130 a barrel. Some grades was higher than that. The Aussie dollar was a bit higher, but that translated into petrol prices, which are around where they are today.
Yeah.
Whereas now we're looking at a world oil price, which is, what, 86, 85, 86, 87, if you look at Brent, maybe towards 90, way below that level, and yet we're paying similar petrol prices, even when you adjust for the fuel excise that temporarily occurred around the Ukraine war. So the only explanation I can come up with is that someone's getting a bigger margin here, and it's probably oil refineries. Unfortunately, in Australia, we've shut down a lot of our oil refineries, so we're at the beck and call of the rest of the world on this one.
So where do you think petrol prices are going to top at in the next few weeks?
Look. I know Sydney. I live here. I think the short-term discounting cycle is on the way up for a little while. It could go a little bit higher, $2.40 potentially. I hope not. Hope it doesn't get that high up. A lot really depends on what happens globally. If there is an expansion of the conflict around Israel to include Iran, then yes, we could go a lot higher from here. Hopefully that doesn't occur and prices settle down again. But I must admit, that is, if I'm looking at the world at present, that is obviously one big risk.
Okay, well, that's it for today. Thanks, Shane, and see you next time.
Thanks, Deanna. Take care.
For more info on Shane and Deanna's podcasts and reports, head to the Insights Hub at amp.com.au.